Hi, I'm Sue Stevens with WNIJ. We are hoping that this is going to be the first in a continuing collaboration between the Rockford Register Star and WNIJ about very important issues to our region. And today, the issue is pensions, the pension system in Illinois. Now, we know that we have a $100 billion pension shortfall, worst in the nation. Let's get into that with a discussion with our guest today. We are going to be speaking with Steve Cunningham. He's the Vice President of Administration at NIU, State Senator Dave Severson, and the Rockford Register Star's political editor, Chuck Sweeney. So let's start out first with how did we get here, this $100 billion pension shortfall? Dave.
Okay, well, it's a great question. And first, thank you for covering this. You know, talking about pensions, I'm sure, is never exciting. It's just like going to the doctor is not exciting. But it's important because what's happening with the pensions is crowding out everything else. And so it's affecting education. It's affecting health care. It's affecting human services. It's affecting law enforcement. And so the issue does have to be addressed. And the problem has been really since 1990, legislators have been putting their head in the sand. If we really go back to see where the problem began, the problem really started in 1990. That's when the legislature got together with labor groups, and they decided to change the pension plan and do a couple of things, but most impacting is the fact they added a 3% compounding COLA to the pensions. That was never done before, so it's interesting. Interesting, in 1970, when the Constitution was passed, there was no such thing as COLAs or compounding. And so when they say that the Constitution guarantees that, well, it was never even around at those times. But in 1990, they started the 3% compounding. They also moved up the retirement age. And at that point, people were starting to live longer. And so it really, from 1990 going forward, it was really a Ponzi scheme. It was never meant to work. The math could never work. But it was done in collaboration with legislators and union leaders, and they put that in place. And since then, we've been trying to fix this system, or at least warn people of the problem, but it kept getting pushed off and pushed off to where we are today.
I can add just a little bit to what Dave said as well. Even going back further as just prior to the Constitutional Convention in 1970, a decision was made to transfer the responsibility for making the pension payments from the institutions, these being school districts and universities, community colleges, to the state. We're not sure why that decision was made. It probably had something to do with budgeting and appropriations, but that started the set of circumstances that really has led to the unfunded liabilities that we face today, because there was a failure to adequately fund, to pay the full contributions during several fiscal years. And, of course, if you get that in the pipeline, it begins to compound and grow into the scale of problem we have today. In most states, the responsibility for making pension payments is directly that of the employer. So in other states, universities, for example, have a budget line right there with the salary to pay for retirement benefits. And usually they also pay for Social Security in other states, where here we do not participate in Social Security. So that provides for a very stable funding mechanism that we've not had in the state of Illinois for some time.
We're in a situation where in the Constitution, it says pension benefits can't be lowered.
Diminished.
And we're running out of money, even though we had a temporary income tax increase that may become permanent, that brought in $7 billion a year, which has mostly gone for pension payments. But we don't seem to be getting out of the deep water. In fact, we seem to be getting into it worse. And the legislature has not been meeting round the clock to solve this problem. And I wondered, what is the sense of a crisis? Is there one? Because if there were, I mean, you wouldn't be here. You'd be down stuck in a room on the fourth floor of the Capitol.
We'd have you by phone, and you'd have to hurry it up.
Well, and that's one of the frustrations, as Chuck, as you know, because you've been one of those that has understood this issue and has covered it for literally for decades. 1995, I introduced my first piece of legislation dealing with this pension issue. As a numbers guy, I could see that this system was not going to work. And it's not just because of the irresponsibility of underfunding, which most of that occurred after 2002 on the larger scale, but about half of the pension shortfall is caused by people who are living longer, salaries that are increasing faster than what the contributions can catch up and lower returns on the pension funds. A combination of those has created a perfect storm, and taking that crisis, which was going to hit eventually, and move that crisis up to where it is now today. But even for most legislators, unfortunately, that don't understand the finances, their idea is, well, we can still push it off till tomorrow. We can always bond it. And it's that lack of urgency that gets states and governments into trouble. And so right now, while they understand they have to reform the system, no one wants to make that adult decision. They want to talk about it, but they don't want to actually make that decision because they know it's going to involve some pain. It has to involve pain. You're not going to fix a $150 to $200 billion hole without somebody feeling some pain. And so at some point, the legislators are going to have to step up and come up with a plan that's going to have shared pain. The question is what can be the fairest way to fix it and spread the risk out and so everyone partakes in it? And how do we get the best out of a bad situation? And that's what we have to get legislators to do, which historically they've never had to do. It's always, what program can we expand or how can we borrow money to spend? They're not in the position of saying no. They've never had to say no before, so it's kind of a new experience for them.
Now, Steve Cunningham, you've come up with a plan for the university system. And I want you to describe some of the details of that, and then to extrapolate, is that something that could work throughout the state?
Sure. We collaborated with the leadership of the universities, the presidents and chancellors, as well as employee constituencies, annuitant groups, and so on. And it was also at the request of leadership representatives that we met with in Springfield that we kind of worked toward some alternative options on this matter because of the necessity to get the problem fixed. And as Dave said, it's going to require a model of shared sacrifice, on the part of because of the scale of the problem, simply on the part of participants, state obligations, and institutional obligations as well, because this is a great matter of urgency for our workforces in terms of retention and recruitment. So our plan has been, and it came out in the spring of this year before some of the current legislative proposals were out. But it's called a so-called six-step proposal, and it involves basically three different components. One is an increase in contributions to the system on the part of the employers, a phase-in of the normal cost at the rate of 0.5% per year. That's designed to take some obligation off of the state and perhaps mitigate the depth of benefit cuts that might otherwise need to be made for participants. And then also a 2%, a phased-in 2% increase in contributions on behalf of current employees who are participating in the SERS, the Tier 1 plan. Then the second area involves actual core benefits. The major driver of obligations, as Dave indicated, and unfunded liabilities is the cost of living, the 3% compounded cost of living. And that's important. Compounding is important to maintain the security, retirement security for participants, especially for those who do not participate in Social Security. So this is the only pension system that participants have. But we've suggested revising that to one-half CPI instead of just the arbitrary 3% compounded. That would retain retirement security. It would provide some level of inflation protection in the event of high inflation years, and would also substantially reduce the unfunded liabilities. The other aspect is called the effective rate of interest, and this is the rate of return posted to employee accounts, participant accounts, for what's called the money purchase formula. So the State University's retirement system and has two primary formulas. There's a general formula, 2.2% times average salary times years of service, or there's an alternative general formula, which or money purchase formula, that takes the sum of contributions plus applied interest, the effective rate of interest, places these into a summary account, divides them by a so-called annuity factor, which is based on age. And this then comes up with an alternative calculation. And the money purchase calculation had driven a higher annuity for almost 70% of participants. So it was substantial. But it had a rate of return that had been determined by the CSRS board of the state comptroller. It's currently around 7.5%. And this is really a risk-free investment. So we said the effective rate of interest going forward, not going backward, going forward, should be 75 basis points above a 30-year Treasury bond. So it's benchmarked on a conservative financial investment. And that, too, has a big effect on long-term unfunded liabilities. Then the last two components related to a Tier 2, which we have suggested implementing what's called a hybrid plan. It's a combination of so-called defined benefits, where it's a formula-driven benefit, and then a defined contribution, where monies are placed into account and invested by the participant under certain options provided by the retirement system. And that would be somewhat more competitive in our market than the current Tier 2. And finally, and very importantly, and Dave mentioned this as well, is the introduction of a new funding plan. Sort of a reamortization of existing unfunded liabilities, which we were on a bit of a balloon payment because of the so-called ramp associated with the 1995 funding plan. And it's a very high, I think, as a percent of payroll, the state is paying almost 35% into the pension plans. And we think that probably is not sustainable long term. So we would suggest reamortizing this to a straight, flat line, closed 35-year amortization plan that would substantially reduce unfunded liabilities and stabilize the pension contributions going forward with certain guarantees.
Dave, how is this playing with the legislature?
And we follow with the plan that the universities put forward, which I think many felt was a fair plan that really addressed a lot of the issues. What they're looking at now with the latest proposal is integrating part of that, which would include the changing the COLA. Instead of 3%, it would be one-half the rate of inflation, but there would be a floor, most likely at 1 or 1.5%. It wouldn't go below that, and then a ceiling that could be anywhere from 4 to 5%. So there would be that would change. But The interesting thing is the compounding factor. The difference from 3% to 1.5%, for example, over 30 years, you're talking about tens and tens of billions of dollars. So it is that is the largest factor of that, saying that if we go to a range, that doesn't mean that people are going to lose. If we end up in a higher inflationary time, like in the past, they could be getting compounding as high as that. As close to 3% already. And so that's important to realize. But just the opposite, and it's going to be hard for the public to understand this, but just the opposite is instead of having increased contributions, this proposal actually reduces contributions that are being made by 1%. Now, the first thing people are going
to understand that too.
Yeah, first people are going to say, wait a second, you've got a problem in you reducing the contribution. And let's look quickly at why. Number one is, interesting enough, 1% contribution or 2% contribution adds very little to the math of it. The compounding is everything. You could increase contributions by 3% and it wouldn't come close to touching what 1% reduction in the compounding would be. But when you're taking this to court, as Chuck mentioned at the very beginning, the law says you cannot diminish a pension. So if you're going to adjust the COLA that they're going to receive, but then you reduce their contribution, that addresses the consideration rule. Now you can go to court and say, yes, you may get a little bit less compounding, but you're contributing less now as well. So part of that is the reason for the reduction is to be able to help win the legal case, even though the public case is going to be harder to get them to understand, wait a second, you're going to be contributing less to a problem that this is big, but they believe that that's might be needed as a way to actually get this passed.
Public doesn't really have a lot of input in this, though.
No, they don't. But but the decisions that are made are public-driven. That's been the frustration with this pension. Every time you add a pension sweetener, that's because of public input and demand from voters or special interest groups. And so that's what got us into this position. And so now there's a court of public opinion. Legislators have to vote on something that's being perceived as, wait a second, you're going to lower their contributions. You're just giving in to the unions. And so we need to understand that this is part of winning the big picture. You may have to do that as a way to be able to actually get the savings that you want in place.
Steve, what kind of feedback have you gotten on your plan? You got some pushback from the faculties, didn't you?
It's interesting. We went across the state and presented the plan to at many of the university campuses. We were invited to attend pension summits and present to the faculties and the staff of the various universities and also annuitants associations across the state. And I think the predominant reaction has been, gosh, we've got to do something to stabilize the situation. It's not indefinitely sustainable, and probably the actions that would be necessary to take out into the future are going to be more severe than what might be able to be done at this time if we can stabilize it. So there's a sense that we're sort of on the cusp of this, and that action does need to be taken. We also have received some certainly negative feedback because, as you mentioned in the beginning, Chuck, it's a constitutionally guaranteed benefit. Personnel go through their careers. They rely on these benefits. They plan for them. It is a replacement for Social Security. And here we are at a point where we need to contemplate some adjustments, even though it's a shared sacrifice model. So certainly the feedback is mixed, but in general there is a sense of understanding and commitment to realizing that there does have to be some changes made.
I think there's a great disconnect between the employees covered by this kind of a pension and the general public who's not covered by a union, not represented by anybody except themselves.
Right.
And defined benefit pensions went away a long time ago for most of us. We have 401ks, and there's nobody increasing that except if the stock market does well. And so, most people are saying, yeah, I understand you've got this great pension, but we don't have anything like that, and we haven't gotten raises, and yeah. We can't afford even more taxes to pay for it. I don't think they have any ill will against, public employees. They do a good job. But it's just kind of an economic circumstance that most of us aren't in.
And as a matter of disclosure, let's say, look around this table and see how many people are affected by the decisions made on this pension system directly with their own. I am an employee of Northern Illinois University, which means I'm a state employee, so I'm raising my hand. And
absolutely, me too.
It's, yep, it's, and every proposal that you know, that I've supported reduces and cuts mine. But again, the important thing is that people need to understand the system is not sustainable the way it is. They can talk about, and unfortunately what happens is union leadership and other people tell their members, oh, we can get through this. They just have to have a little more, put a little more money into the system. It's not going to work. If you run the math out for the next 10 years, the system will collapse. You can't raise taxes high enough in Illinois to make it work. So the system is going to collapse, and we don't know what will happen. The pension may be guaranteed, but when a system this size collapses and the federal courts come in, that word diminished benefits may be changed or defined differently by the courts. So it is important that a solution be found to this. And a couple concerns, or a couple things I just want to again stress, because one of the things we hear a lot was, you know, you legislators, if you would have just funded these pensions like you should have, we wouldn't have this problem. Well, number one, some of us have voted against every budget that didn't fund the pensions. But the biggest skipping of pensions that happened in 2002, 2003, 2004, we need to understand that the decision to skip the pension payment was made by not only the legislators, but the union leadership in Illinois was a party to that. They endorsed the plan to skip the pension payments. So they were, and now they're turning around and saying, yeah, well, we told them not to make the payments because we wanted to spend the money elsewhere, but now it's their fault. So I think it's important to point out the blame for this really goes to both the union leadership as well as legislators back then who were irresponsibly not doing their job. So we're faced with this problem now, and that's why, how do we fix it? And I think the proposal that's being talked about right now, which is reducing the COLA for younger people, I think under 45, you would lose, I think, five of your COLAs maybe every other year when you do eventually retire, is part of that. The concern with the legislation is part of the bill is that they guarantee funding, and they also guarantee that it can't be part of collective bargaining. Well, the problem is that guarantee means nothing because next year a simple majority of the next legislature can change that. So unless you're going to put that into the Constitution that guarantees that the state has to make a certified payment every year, you're at the same mercy of a future legislature acting irresponsibly. So I would hope that if a funding plan is in place, that they look seriously at putting that into some kind of a stronger law that makes it difficult for the legislature to change in the future.
Yeah, given the history in Illinois, the security of the funding plan, as Dave indicated, is critical to constituent and employee support of whatever compromises are eventually reached. That's really critical. One thing that gets back to our discussion a little bit is the sense that state employees, university employees, have pensions that are overly generous or are atypical in terms of the magnitude. And you know, I talk to a lot of people about this, and first, our employees don't participate in Social Security. So this is a replacement for Social Security. Most, in fact, all private sector employees do participate in Social Security, and the employers are required to make that Social Security match every year to the federal government or every payroll cycle of the federal government. And in addition, typically there are some 401k type or 403b type contributions also made on behalf of the employee. So that's very similar to a hybrid plan like we're discussing. Then when we look at the normal cost of our plan, and that's the actual cost of the plan to pay the benefits out into the future, it's around 12% now, but it's going to go back to the 6.5%, 7%, 8% range over a period of years because of the effect of Tier 2 averaging in with Tier 1. That's a very cost-effective plan. That's not much higher than the normal cost of Social Security. And if you look in the private sector or at even the public sector and look at what the average employer normal cost obligations are for the pension plans, typically that includes Social Security plus some other defined contribution or defined benefit plan that they're contributing to in addition to that, the national averages exceed, they're north of 13-14%. So one thing I try to do is to put some of this in the context. It's not the case that it's just a overly excessive type of plan, and that leads to unsustainable obligations. It's really been the history of funding and not taking account in terms of contributions paid in what are necessary to pay for the benefits, as Dave indicated.
One thing we forgot to mention was in 2010 we did pass pension reforms for new hires.
Right.
The problem itself will be corrected if they don't change those pensions mm-hmm. in about 33 or 34 years from now.
But meanwhile, we've got to fund.
Yeah.
We can't get to there.
We have to fund the rest of the government now.
Right. So the problem fixes itself in 35 years, yeah. But we can't get there until
be here,
we.
So.
You may. We can't get there until then. But on the issue about Social Security, again, that gets raised an awful lot, and we have to remember that the reason to give up Social Security was something that they bargained for, and the decision to give up Social Security was something that labor wanted to do and push through a number of years ago. We do have a problem, though, with excess pensions. The system was never really anticipated the salaries that were going to be made, especially the end of career salaries and the fact that people were going to be living longer. Now, a lot of this is regional, which is why I like the idea of having local governments getting back to participating, because what we have is more suburban and Cook County school districts that are paying huge salaries to their teachers and to their administrators.
They're not paying for the pension
because
cost.
The state picks up. It's not Rockford, for example. Yeah. I think Rockford's got like 30 teachers that are making over $100,000. But the problem we're having in our system, we have in Illinois today, we have over 10,000 retirees whose pensions are over $100,000 a year. Mm-hmm. So when we say, well, it's just like the private sector with their 401ks and Social Security, I think anyone in the private sector would give up their 401k and their Social Security if they could get $100,000 a year compounding a year.
You mean they would?
They would give it up. We have 10,000 that are over $100,000, and within 15 years, that goes to 26,000 people with pensions over $100,000 a year. That's the part that's unsustainable. And so addressing that is what we're trying to do.
And I'll be living in Florida, so I won't help.
And a lot of them living in Florida, and they're not paying taxes, state taxes on that money. So one of the ideas of shifting part of it to local is to force those school districts to be more responsible in these ideas of end of career.
And that's really unpopular in downstate Illinois, any place outside of Chicago. That's seen as a cost shift that's unfair by both the administrations, the school boards, and the unions. So that seems like a tough hill to climb.
It is a tough hill, but it's something that I think more downstate are understanding the ramifications of doing that unless they put some other real safeguards in there. Part of, I think, our new system we have in place now, if school districts give raises above a certain level over a period of time, then that local school district is responsible for that. We have to do something to curb that kind of abuse because, again, the system can't sustain that kind of a level, especially with the system earning lower interest rates, which is another thing. The market's going to be shaky going forward. I mean, this year has been good, but it's being artificially pumped in because of the Fed's. The last 10 years, we've averaged 6% in the market. The whole system is predicated on averaging, on the teachers, is predicated on averaging 8% a year, which is higher than what other states do as well. That's a way to help reduce your payments by the state, by artificially using higher assumptions. And so we're heading into a time when people are living longer, salaries are increasing, funds are earning less, and the state's revenues are becoming more and more difficult. And so that's why we've got this perfect storm that has to be addressed.
This local option only affects the teacher's retirement system portion, correct?
Yes.
Of this. Is there something similar in the planning for state university retirement system?
There is. That was the design of the cost shift proposal mm-hmm. that would have applied just to the universities and community colleges in Senate Bill 1687. It was supported by the leadership of the institutions for the reasons Dave mentioned. Number one, that we believe, just as sound public policy, and it's consistent with practices in other states, that the institution should be responsible for the obligations associated with payroll expenditures, whatever they are. The universities are in sort of a unique market where we do run into a wide range of different pay scales associated with, you know, some of the top faculty in the national market, professional employees, specialists, you know, as well as our staff and other professional employees. And so we have to compete in those markets. And we've so that was one basis behind the cost shift. The other thing was the discussion with leadership of certain business process efficiencies that we need some legislative help with, dealing with procurement, employment, property control, a wide range of things like that that can assist us and facilitate our being as efficient and competitive as possible compared to other institutions mm-hmm. in other states and other sectors.
Is this something we expect to get solved this fall, or, and it's for both of you, or you think that we'll have to wait for next January to make progress? Because every day the meter is running and we are spending, you know, we are incurring more debt every day. And I go back to the point I made earlier. There doesn't seem to be any crisis mentality among the legislators to get down there, as one of the governor candidates said, you know, get the four tops in a room, the four legislative leaders, and the eight people on the pension committee, and shut the door, and you don't get to come out until you've got a solution. That's the way some governors have done it in the past.
That's the way it should have been done. The fact that there's no urgency, again, tells you the fact that they don't care. They certainly understand the issue, but putting it off is something they believe, not dealing with it, they get less heat from their core constituencies than dealing with it.
Yeah, but you've got a core constituency too, because
that's why
going to affect everybody. I don't think we can look at it as a partisan issue that only affects one group, because, you know, money for schools, money for universities, money for mental health, money for the prison system, state police, everything we do. What are we spending about 20% on pensions now?
Well, now this year about $7 billion out of our $35 billion, so it's $1 billion.
I'm not a math major, so I don't know.
It's $1 billion increase, but I guess what I'm saying is that many of these who derive a lot of their support from the unions are, you know, afraid to come out and jump on a plan that's going to hurt where a lot of their contributions are coming from. My frustration is we're talking about $17 million a day. The gangrene is getting worse, or the cancer is getting worse. Every day we wait, that means the surgery that gets done is going to be more painful and more extensive. And that's the anger, that we should be down there now because we wait another week. You know, that's another $100 million that we're going to be further behind. It's irresponsible that they're not making the decision. I think they'll come up with something before the end of the year because they'd like to have it off the table before going into the election year. And so I think you'll get something done in October. I hope it'll be close to what's being talked about, because that will be enough of a permanent fix that'll get us the 35 years until the new system comes into place. If they do a partial fix, You know, then the problem is, which is history of government, if they do a partial fix similar to what the Cullerton plan is, you know, that gets them by 10 years, which for many of them, they say that's great because then I'll be done and I'll be gone and it'll be someone else's problem. But that fix will be much harder in 10 years. So why not just do it now and get it over with?
Steve, do you have a crystal ball where you can kind of look into the future and see what you think might be done?
Well, I think Dave's better positioned to kind of have that information. But in terms of the just the necessity of implementing reform and stabilization, that's in the, you know, the leadership of the universities, at least, regard this as one of their highest priorities because of the effect it has on our recruitment and retention and competitiveness of, to have the best faculty and staff possible. We've seen at all of the public universities 30-40% turnover over the last 3 or 4 years, largely prompted by uncertainty about pensions and benefits, and we're finding it increasingly difficult to compete in the market, especially for the higher-end professionals and faculty members that we need to sustain our institutions long-term.
That's something that you know, doesn't occur to people much, you know, that that effect of it. How else is our universities being affected by the pension crisis?
Well, the other big factor, and Dave has mentioned this as well, is the stabilization of the state budget. You know, the state has a number of fixed obligations that have to be made, and so the discretionary funds are very limited. And more of these are obligated toward the required pension payments. And for the universities, the level of state support for higher education has, you know, of necessity really because of this, been reduced significantly in recent years. It's down now 22-23% of the university budgets, and the leadership of the universities places a very high priority on stabilizing that, at least knowing and being able to rely on what the state appropriations are and having a timely receipt of those monies is very significant. And maybe even someday we could look at marginal increases in state appropriations again.
Well, I think that's a point that listeners need to understand. From a real dollar, not inflated dollars, but from real dollars, Northern Illinois is getting less money from the state than they did 10 years ago. The end result of that is tuition increases, which is a tax increase for all the students and for their families. This year, when you had to increase your pension payment by $1 billion, that means they had to reduce the funding that's going to higher education and to K-12 programs, which is property tax increases. So not fixing this pension issue affects everybody, not just those with pensions. And that's why we need to fix this as we move forward into this next year's budget. And by the way, it's not just the state of Illinois. We're right now trying to deal with the Chicago problem. They irresponsibly, for the last 5 years, have been skipping pensions. This year, the Chicago school system has to now make a $400 million pension payment. They have $1 billion shortfall. They are not sustainable. That system is on the verge of collapsing. And they're down in Springfield asking us to bail their system out. So it's not just, unfortunately, the state's pension system, but now it's the Chicago pension system that's affecting Illinois taxpayers as well.
This is just an epic accounting challenge. How much will politics play in the end? Do you think everyone can actually get together and make changes?
It's all politically driven, and that's unfortunate. If you would just make financial decisions, those could have been made a long time ago. And that's where we need elected officials to make adult decisions. They all want to act like Santa Claus. They love to give away the gifts. But when it comes time to act responsible, you know, then they're nowhere to be seen, and that's when they want to push off or borrow or underfund, which is, you know, the last 10, 12 years, it's been really a growing problem of not being responsible. So this is the first time in a decade that leaders have to make responsible decisions. Now the question is will they do it, and will they do it and get it fixed once and for all, which if we do, then everyone will have assurance. Retirees, active employees, taxpayers will know that the issue was resolved. The bonding agencies will know that. That means Illinois can borrow money at a lower rate than what we're borrowing at now. It gives stability to companies who want to move to Illinois. When you have national articles being written in Wall Street talking about the uncertainty of Illinois' financial stability, you're not going to get a Caterpillar wanting to expand in Illinois because of the uncertainty. We need to send the message that Illinois is financially sound for all of these reasons, and that's the frustrating part, that these leaders won't go down there and say, let's just go there next week, let's pass this thing and get it done. And if these leaders don't want to do it, step aside and let those of us who are willing to make the decisions do it.
Well, the governor could call you down there anytime you want.
He could, but he's not going to. And again, it's all about the politics, talking tough but not doing it. If he were really serious, he would say, I'm going to call special session every single day until you hear, until it gets it resolved. And then the legislature may say, well, it costs money to be in special session. Yep, but not $17 million a day that we're going deeper into debt. So if they're serious, but unfortunately, a lot of this is, you know, playing to the media, saying we're going to get tough on this, and then it never gets done. So I believe that it'll be done in October. If it doesn't, you know, again, I'll be very disappointed, but I guess not surprised at what's happened in Illinois and with the leadership.
When can we expect to see some sort of difference? If there's a plan developed in October, how is that going to affect us here in Illinois?
If the plan is passed in October and implemented right away, for example, the plan that's on the table right now, at least being discussed, what you would see is a liability reduction in the 2015 budget. That would be the budget that would be starting July of 14, that you would see between a $1.2 and a $1.5 billion reduction in the pension liability payment. Now, we believe and we are urging the legislature to still make that payment because the court challenges won't be done yet. But there will be, the savings is incremental starting the first year at somewhere between $1.2 and $1.5 billion. And over the 30 years, you're talking about $140 billion in savings. That's not a small amount of money. And so the savings can be felt right away. The improved bond rating would be felt right away. And that means the money that we're borrowing to fix our roads and our schools and our bridges, the cost to borrow money goes down. That means millions of dollars more into actually bricks and mortar instead of into financing. And so there's a lot of things that can happen with just the passing of this being implemented. Plus, as we said before, it gives some assurance to retirees and soon-to-be retirees and active employees that their system is going to be there. And the proposals that are being looked at, whether it's the university one or this new hybrid off of that, it's important to understand that no one is going to lose any part of their pension. The issue is only about the amount of the increased COLA that's going to happen, and that COLA may fluctuate, but there's no talk about doing anything that would negatively affect what the base pension is that anyone is receiving.
And that's very important. It doesn't affect earned pensions either from current employees or retirees. It's all going forward in terms of the rate of growth of those earned benefits. And that's very positive aspect of this. In terms of a 30-year plan, there's no magic to a 30-year plan. It could be a 35-year plan, even a 40-year plan. The key, as Dave mentioned, is having very sound, locked-in financing. And that by itself will stabilize the financial markets, the bond ratings, several factors that currently contribute to the problem.
This will most likely end up in the courts, and that's why I think what they're trying to do is address some of these issues with having consideration in there as a part of it. The other, you know, argument as well, as I said at the very beginning, in 1970, when they passed the Constitution that said you cannot diminish a benefit, there wasn't any compounding COLAs. That didn't come along for 20 years. So clearly the courts didn't, or the legislature, when they say diminish, they never had that intended to be the compounding COLAs. But that's still part of it, and I understand that, and that was a promise that was made. And that's one thing that's important. You know, I know a lot of state employees say, well, this was a promise that was made. And we understand that, but the economy has changed. Those are the same promises that were made to, you know, to Chuck and his 401k plan. Those are the promises that were made to United Airline workers when they were working there, and their pension is now 100% taken away from them. So everybody has been affected by the economy change in this country. And so it's not like we're treating one group different than another. We're saying everybody is going to get some hurt from this. If we don't do this, if we say, no, the government class is not going to get hurt, then we're extending that caste system where government people are getting better pensions and health care and increasing pensions, and then the rest of the working people are getting less and less and less. And that's not what we really wanted in the representative form of government. So I think the idea of having a resolution where everybody gives something and we can get some fix here makes sense. It could take a year, year and a half going through the court system, and maybe longer if there's appeals. But just passing it will improve the bonding. And we know that if we can, if we don't take the savings right away, we wait for a year, we know it's coming. And so, again, the sooner we pass it, the sooner it can get through the court challenge.
And the sooner we get through all this and stop being known as the worst pension system in the nation. Steve, what do you see as what this is going to mean positively for the people of Illinois?
Well, first of all, you know, as we've discussed, this is the single biggest metric in terms of destabilizing and skewing the state budget process. And Illinois can have it's a vibrant state, a great deal of economic activity, and this is a situation that is detrimental both to the interest of the state, but also to participants in the pension systems that rely on these benefits. And so in terms of the direct interests of the universities, in terms of stabilizing their workforces, recruiting, retaining the best and the brightest, this is an issue, the first of some several issues, but the very top issue that needs to be resolved going forward.
Dave?
Well, and if we help improve Illinois' job climate, the fact that we continue to mire at around 48 in the country when it comes to job creation, when I think we're number one in migration of jobs leaving the state, fixing the pension is a small portion of that. But if we can get, again, the legislature to make adult decisions when it comes to addressing the core reasons of why Illinois is doing so poorly, which is dealing with workers' compensation, unemployment rules, the environmental and other regulatory things that make it so difficult for businesses to be in Illinois, if we would make those changes and you had the same growth that Indiana or Iowa or North Dakota or Texas or others are doing, if we had that growth, you're talking about significant increases in revenue to the state of Illinois, which would also relieve a lot of these pressures here. Because we're asking the state to continue to do more with less, just like locals, now that we're seeing property taxes going down, we're asking local districts to do more with less. If we don't change our jobs climate, we're going to be spiraling downward, because the talk now is about what more taxes can we raise. That's going to slow the economy down. That means there's going to be less revenue, less people working, less people able to contribute to the pension system. So we have to change that jobs philosophy. If we do that, we can grow out of this. This is fixable. It's a serious problem, but it is fixable. That's the good news. And we see how quickly other states have turned around. Illinois, with doing some pension reform, a few business reform changes, and we can have our best and brightest days ahead. But that means we need legislators acting like adults, making difficult decisions that are necessary for us to move forward so we can give the next generation the same opportunities that we had.
Well, I think Governor Quinn should call the legislature into special session now and tell them we're going to do this every day until we solve the problem.
And that also means the governor. You know, last time he called a special session on pensions, he wasn't even there and didn't show up for a lot of those meetings.
But so he did take your paycheck away.
He did take our paycheck away. And so,
but you're independently wealthy.
Yeah. but it is important that it's more than just sound bites, and it's holding people accountable. You can't just talk about the issue. You have to actually be there and be part of that. And the governor needs to be there, be at the table. Many legislators are afraid to vote for some of these reforms because they'll say, we'll take the heat to vote for this, but if the governor's going to veto it, then you know, why would I want to vote for it in the first place? He needs to be at the table along with those other leaders to say, let's agree to this, and I will agree to actually sign that bill when we have that agreement.
But he's not doing the kind of jawboning that I've seen in the past where he's got a plan and he's going to push that through, by golly, by hook or by crook. And if he needs the vote of Senator so-and-so and that guy needs a couple roads fixed, okay, we could do that. I mean, that's the way you do it. It doesn't sound very pleasing, but it's making sausage.
Well, but he needs to at least support a plan. He keeps saying we have to do reform, but at this point he hasn't endorsed any plan or supported any plan or made his own proposal. And that's what a number of members in his party are saying, that we're not going to go out on a limb if he's not going to tell us and lay his cards on the table as well.
Well,
and
pretty so soon there won't be any limbs, so
well,
we better
they've
get
play,
going on the tree.
His party's got to play better in the sandbox, and so they need to get together. And that's why the governor needs to be at those pension reform meetings, and he needs to embrace and endorse a particular plan or present his own plan or promise to sign an agreement that is reached so members of his party can have that assurance that that's what's going to happen. So it's not just about talking in the media, but it's being there and actually supporting a plan. I think if he did that, you would see some faster movement as well.
All right. Thank you so much, everyone. Steve Cunningham, Vice President of Administration at Northern Illinois University.
Thank you.
State Senator Dave Severson, and co-host of this continuing collaboration between the Register Star and WNIJ, Chuck Sweeney.